Special podcast right here on Sports Talk Chicago. On today's show, we'll be welcoming in a very special guest to talk about a number of sports economics related issues, including the NCAA and its exploitation of players, some Chicago Cubs news and their financial situation, and so much more. But don't let that fool you. We'll also be having lots of fun during this interview. We'll take a look back at his amazing teaching tenure here at the University of Chicago. Plus, later in the show, we'll play a very fun game that has to do with emails, and believe me, it's something that you won't want to miss. And also, if you're a first-time listener or you've been with me for the past 4 years, I'd like to take this time to thank you for your listenership, and I hope you're looking forward to this interview just as much as I am. Before we get started today, make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Instagram at JohnZags, Twitter at JohnZSports, and LinkedIn at JohnZagluel. Today's show is brought to you by Moochie World, where inspiration meets creation. Call 708-247-2100 to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art projects for adults and children. Moochie World, creativity at its finest. And by the Windy City Thunderbolts. Celebrate the team's 20th anniversary season by purchasing tickets right now. Call 708-489-2255 for your chance to be a part of history this summer in Crestwood. It's now time for our special guest. He's an economics graduate from the University of Chicago and Brigham Young University. Following his graduation, he began some teaching stints at Princeton and William & Mary before returning to UChicago in 1984 as an associate provost and senior research scientist at the National Opinion Research Center. Just 4 years later, he began his teaching career, serving as the pioneer for Econ 100 and 102, two courses that he still teaches to this day. He's also a noted sports economist, Chicago Life columnist, and Quantrell Award winner. Please welcome Professor Alan Sanderson to the show. Professor, how are you doing today? Thank you for being here on the show.
I'm doing fine, and it's a little warmer today. and thanks a lot for having me. My pleasure.
Well, to start today, Professor, with March Madness just wrapping up, now let's look past the glitz and glamour of the tournament for a moment and talk about the true issue of the tournament, which is something that I think has been overlooked quite a lot, and that involves players not being paid for their talents. We're seeing college athletes across the board, including in March Madness, almost being exploited in a way by the NCAA. Can you give me a breakdown of how the system currently works right now, along with your thoughts on the situation?
Well, one, I think comparison is relevant to 1984. If I do it in inflation-adjusted dollars, in 1984, CBS paid the NCAA $14 million to broadcast March Madness. This year they paid more than $1 billion. Okay? It's a 100-fold increase to give you some type of idea of just how much money is on the table. And the money is largely gobbled up by the NCAA and the institutions, not the players. Also, if you're not paying the players, which they're not, you have an overwhelming tendency to just expand the schedule. You don't expand the schedule very much in the NBA or NFL or NHL. Why? It's not profitable for the owners. Beyond a certain point, if we played another game, we've got to give the players half and we get half. It probably doesn't make sense. But when you can keep it all and you're not giving the players anything, it might make a sense to play. So 1984, the teams going to the Final Four were probably playing around their 25th game. This year, those who went to the Final Four are playing their 38th, 39th, or 40th game of the season. So it's expanded enormously because it's cheap. In addition, what I think is the most shameful probably of all, if I look at the starters for the Final Four teams, 80% of those players are black. And so we are basically exploiting those guys. And we just ought to be ashamed of it.
You know, I've heard you mention in class before the idea that the NCAA is a monopoly because today players who want to go to the pros or want to go to the NBA, MLB, whatever it may be, have to go through the NCAA first and play at least a couple of years collegiately. So from a college basketball standpoint, sticking with the March Madness tournament, how does the one-and-done rule fit in specifically to that idea, and what are your thoughts on that rule?
Well, the one-and-done, which means I can't enter the NBA until I'm 19, or 1 year out of high school. So it's not really, so I go to college for a year and then I become eligible. It's not really one and done. It's more like 7 months and done. Because I assume that the Final Four players were not in their chemistry classes on Monday morning following the tournament. It's an oddity. And by the way, I should say that the commissioner of the National Basketball Association, Adam Silver, is a law graduate from the University of Chicago. So we're kind of complicit in this, I suppose. It's interesting because if I'm a talented kid, I'm a smart kid, I'm athletically talented, I turn 18, I can get a driver's license, I can work for Macy's, I can play Major League Baseball, I can play on the tennis tour, I can play on the golf tour, I can drive an Indy car on the Indy 500, I can join the Army and defend the country, I can vote. There are just two occupations I can't do. I can't play professional basketball. I can't play professional football because those cartels or monopolies have basically frozen that out.
So with the argument established now that we should be paying these college athletes, what's your long-term solution here? Because right now, like for example, there have been solutions proposed saying that we should pay players by prestige. So for example, Zion Williamson making more money than Joey Baker, who's a bench rider on the Duke team. What are your thoughts on the solution here to make this all right?
Yeah, it's not obvious what the solution is. I think it's obvious which direction one ought to go, but how you pull that off, I don't know. Whether, I mean, they're bright that you could tax tickets, and for all practical purposes, in terms of college sports, we're not talking about the University of Chicago or tennis. We're talking about men's basketball and football. Those are the two giant revenue sports. One could be you tax those tickets, put them in a pot when a player later wants to go back to graduate from college or get an MBA degree or start a small business. There's a pot there available. I'm not so concerned. You know, it's probably no shock. Faculty members in the law school and Booth are paid a whole lot more than the French faculty, okay, at the University of Chicago or any institution, and we still smile and, you know, and exist as a community. So there's a variety, and President Zimmer makes a whole lot more than anybody else, but, you know, he's a good guy. So I don't see that one player is making more than another is a problem, certainly in the pros. You know, the quarterback in the NFL is making a whole lot more money than anybody else on the team, and they live with it. Or, you know, Stephon Curry is making a lot of money. Doesn't seem to bother anybody. I'm not sure why it should bother us in college. And even if the quarterback is paid more than the coach, then that's a bit of a problem, but it's not insurmountable.
Professor Alan Sanderson here on Sports Talk Chicago. And Professor, moving to some MLB news. The season's now nearly a month long, yet we have quality players like Craig Kimbrell, Dallas Keuchel, another, for example, who are still out on the open market. And even though Bryce Harper and Manny Machado are on teams right now, it took them till mid-March to sign. So it's been a slow-moving free agent process. Do you find this good or bad for baseball, and what's your take on why it's so slow-moving these days?
Now, I don't necessarily think it's good or bad. It'd be bad if one could show in the smoke-filled back rooms that the owners were colluding, as they were in previous generations, to not sign players. Now, that's against the law, and they should be spending quality time in prison if they did that. But barring that, and there's not much evidence that that was going on. But if Bryce Harper wanted to sign for, you know, $10,000, he could have signed in a heartbeat. When you want several hundred million dollars, yeah, these things are going to drag out. So it's just, I think that's an acceptable process in terms of for the superstars. Also, things change over time. If I go back, say, before free agency, there was no difference in baseball, or even early years of free agency, if I take the first 10 or even 20 years, there was really no difference between the mean salary and the median salary. Today there is. I'm sort of making up the numbers, but the median salary is, let's say, in baseball, $1 million, and the mean salary is probably $3 or $4 million. Why? It's the superstar effect, behind which was Sherwin Rosen, an economist, a good friend of mine at the University of Chicago. And that's largely because of television. Television has just changed dramatically the amount of money that goes into sports, and then who gets it, and the superstars get it, they're going to draw bigger television audiences. So at the moment, the Chicago Bulls are not playing on many national TV games where the Golden State Warriors are. So that's a little bit what's going on in terms of the dynamic. Also, given sports analytics, the sabermetricians and so forth, Bill James and the history of that, there are just different views of how much money does a superstar really generate. What is having a star on your team better than some guy who can, you know, hit 350 or hits a whole bunch of singles or steals bases or something else? It's now the sports analytics is driven where we can almost look at the economic value of different players. So there's, at the moment, I think, not an equilibrium in terms of how will this play out in subsequent years. Again, it's not collusion, it's just what's the value of a particular player. I remember a number of years ago in a lunch with Tom Ricketts, the Cubs owner, saying a particular player, and I won't name him, it was sort of the fans loved him and every teammate in the dugout hated him. And so how do you deal with that, of, you know, the team harmony versus the fans?
So let's transfer this conversation now to the new CBA agreement coming up in 2021 for the MLB, because right now there are lots of players who are complaining about this process, whether it be fair or not. There are many who have complaints about it. Once 2021 comes around, after the year, this is going to be a hot button issue. Yeah. How do you think the MLB will negotiate with the players to resolve it? And also, if it doesn't get resolved, do you see a possible strike happening for Major League Baseball after 2021?
If I were betting a fair amount of money in Las Vegas or a little amount of money, I would bet there wouldn't be a work stoppage. Could be. I mean, certainly the last one, 94-95, I think in many ways was sort of a disaster, and not blaming the players or blaming the owners, but that work stoppage was pretty costly. And not only in terms of lost revenue, but it generated some post-strike things that were probably not healthy for the game. So I really don't know. I'm not privy enough to know how strong and entrenched the player side on the table or the owner side is at this moment. There's a lot of money in professional sports, again, because of television primarily, and a work stoppage is even more costly now.
Speaking of the free agent market, and you mentioned Tom Ricketts earlier, let's talk about the Chicago Cubs, because this offseason, they were quite inactive. They didn't spend lots of money, made a couple of minor signings here or there, but that's also because they have lots of money tied up and a very select amount of players at the moment. Yeah. And now, with the season underway, they've got off to one of their worst starts in recent memory. What do you make of the financial situation surrounding the Cubs, and how do you think it relates to their performance so far here in 2019?
Well, they've just come off a three-game sweep of the Marlins, but I'm not exactly sure that counts as Major League Baseball to beat the Marlins. I think in the end the team's going to be fine. Whether they, you know, will they make the playoffs? Most likely. Will they win the World Series? Unlikely. At that point, making the playoffs, and you should really develop the team and construct the team to make the playoffs. After that, it's just a crapshoot. In a seven-game series, the weaker team has a pretty good chance of winning that series. I think they will probably be fine. One of the reasons they were somewhat inactive over the winter was they have probably the second-highest payroll in Major League Baseball, so I doubt that the ownership was interested in spending a whole lot more money. They've got some very, very talented players on that team. They're also likable guys. And that's going to buy them a lot locally.
Who in your mind right now is the cause of the Cubs' financial situation? Is there someone that you think the Cubs are overpaying at this point that is kind of burdening the team financially, if you had to guess?
Oh, gosh, I wouldn't even hazard a guess on that. I just I know far less about it than the Cubs management. wouldn't go there and wouldn't bet money with them. At the moment, sure, Yu Darvish hasn't been the star that they were hoping, but there's some initial signs that maybe he's turning it around a little. But on anything, you in the same way you're going to have the NFL draft coming up in the first round, you're going to draft 32 guys, and half dozen of them will be busts. You just don't know which ones.
What would be your advice to Cubs chairman and good friend Tom Ricketts as to the team's current performance and its financial state? Anything that you would tell him if he were here right now about the team?
Oh, I would just say get a good night's sleep, have some aspirins, beer occasionally. I think things are going to be fine. And in terms of it's not a tortoise versus hare, slow wins the race as much as it is just patience. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with that team. On the other hand, I won't say on the other hand, but it's a strong division. Pittsburgh or Cincinnati are not very strong, but obviously the Cardinals. And then Milwaukee has put together quite a nice team. They're going to be a formidable opponent.
Now let's shift gears to your teaching career. And I had mentioned in your bio that you originally came to UChicago in 1984 as an associate provost and senior research scientist. And then just 4 years later, you began teaching courses on the side before embracing that role full-time in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So what prompted that career switch, going from an administrative position at first when you came here mm-hmm. to now being a teacher for 30-plus years?
Yeah. Well, when I went to Princeton, associate dean of the graduate school, but then hooked up really quite soon with Steve Goldfeld, who was the chairman at the time, to teach on the side, as it were, for the economics department. So I taught a couple of courses every year for economics. And then when I came here, the late Gail Johnson, a great, great guy and economist, approached me about doing sort of part-time teaching for the department. And I taught, then it was called Econ 198 and 199 instead of 100 and 102. But I taught on Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 8:30 in the morning, so they didn't really interfere with my day job, as it were, and then just sort of developed over time. It's that introductory sequence hasn't been a strong part of the University of Chicago economics tradition or department as it is elsewhere. The sort of Ec 10A and Ec 10B that Greg Behnke was taught for a number of years at Harvard and the equivalent at Princeton and so forth. And so I think over time, people, meaning students, or administrators, have just been more aware of the value of the introductory micro and macro courses. When I first started teaching in the late 80s, I suppose, did 20 to 30 students or something in a class, and now it's 150, only constrained by the room size. And in a typical quarter, there'll be 350 to 400 students bid for those. Ideally, down the road, some of my colleagues in the department would pick up a section or two over the course of the year. I just think the introductory economics, micro, macro, and applied statistics ought to be graduation requirements at any university.
Why do you say that?
They are just the most helpful courses in teaching you how to think. And this combination of economics plus statistics gives you some analytical background as well. You can go a long way. If you know those three courses well, you're really prepared.
What was your experience like in growing these classes? Because you mentioned at the beginning there were 20 or 30 students, and now mm-hmm. today you have people emailing you constantly asking to get in. You have 400 bids on a 150-student class. What has it been like for you to grow this class into what it is today? How has the class changed in any way? Mm-hmm. And also, why do you think it's become so popular amongst the student body?
Well, one reason, I think just general awareness of students going to college.
Right.
And I'm not talking about water polo at USC. students going to college, just realizing the value of economics. Okay. Second, the college, when I started teaching in 1988, there were probably, 2,800, 2,900 students in the college. Now it's more than twice that. That's some of the growth. It's very gratifying to see how many students come. The other, I will say, with University of Chicago students, they come to my office hours or, on a Friday afternoon. Most universities are all universities except this one. You're not going to find students showing up for some office hours on a Friday afternoon in the spring. Here, you do. We're just different. Also, not that the students were not good in 1988, but they've just gotten better and better over time. And so I enjoy teaching, and they're very smart, and they're also very nice. And I enjoy it immensely, and I learn from them because, again, they're engaged and they're so smart. The one regret would be, I suppose, when they're 20 or 25 in the room, I get to know everybody. And when they're 150, I really can't.
And because you've taught both those courses since 1988, you've been honored as teaching the most students ever here at the University of Chicago. No one has taught more students than you. What does that honor mean to you?
Oh, it means a lot. Certainly, if you want to put it on my tombstone, that's okay. It's not as good as Thomas Jefferson's. What he chose of all of the things that he had done was to say, founder of the University of Virginia. That's what he valued most highly. I've had a reasonably successful publishing career and done just some amazing things, almost by accident. But I think for me, that's which I'm most proud.
Now, granted, since you've been teaching here for so long and you've taught the most students in university history, I'm sure there have been some funny moments that you've encountered in your 30-plus years here at UChicago. And one that immediately comes to mind is when you helped catch two armed trespassers near your office on campus this past February. I was sitting in class that day, and you came in, you told your story, everybody got up, gave you a standing ovation as to what happened. So tell me about that experience, and also, is there any other funny moments that could top that one?
Well, actually, earlier that day, I don't want to say that early that day, but after the perps had entered the SIAE hall, I was actually down the hall in our seminar room giving office hours, and I'm not sure whether it was campus security or Chicago police wouldn't let my students out because we were sort of quarantined in this room until they found these guys. And then at some point, they just had to let the students go, so they guided them down the stairs and out of the building. And I went down toward my office and then went a little further, and one of the officers was saying, do you have a key to that restroom? It's a single-user restroom on the floor. And I said, I don't. Let me go see if our administrative colleague has it. And she didn't have a key, but I could see that it was locked. It said locked, the red locked. But I told him, I said, let's get away from the door just in case. But there has to be somebody in there, because the only way that door can be locked is from the inside. They got a couple more guys, got some crowbar to break the door open, and there were the guys. I'd say another funny incident actually happened to me last fall. It was a student who wanted to get into my micro course, Econ 100. She knocked on the door, came in, and said she'd really like to get in, and I just said, I can't, it's full. And it's overflowing, there are 100 people on a wait list, I'm sorry, it's not going to happen. She said, okay, I understand. And she said, and my mother, by the way, says hello. Your mother, she said, my mother was a student of yours a number of years ago in this class. And she said, not only that, she was pregnant at the time with me, meaning the student. And I looked at her and I said, well, technically then you've had this course. she taken aback, and so I reached behind me, grabbed a consent form, signed it, and said, see you on Monday.
And before we let you go today, Professor, it's now time for Sandersonisms the Game. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to give you some copies of your email responses to certain students here at UChicago. These were all submitted to me anonymously via Facebook, other social media sites. Now, I want you to read exactly what you said, and after you do, I'm going to ask you a follow-up question and get to the bottom of why you responded the way you did. So we'll start with email number one. This is in response to a student asking if he can sit in on a lecture. So I want you to read that response for me right there, and then I'll ask you a follow-up question.
Okay. So to him or her.
Yes.
You want to benefit from the experience personally without having to pay any of the costs. I will not benefit from your presence, nor will any of my students. So you are the sole beneficiary of your action. Until Bernie or AOC become president, college is not free. Or Google free rider sometime. one alternative, you send me a check for $300, I'll cash it and distribute $2 to each of the other students in the course, then you can sit in on one lecture. I actually think this particular student, as I recall, I got this, I think, from a student who had a Northwestern email address.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so at that point, is it really an honest person who, or a student who wants to get in, or is it just part of social media kind of game being played? So I do think in that case. I don't like auditors in the course because, again, that you're just free riding. You're getting all this material. You're not paying the university a dime. And you're not really contributing to the class. So that's my general policy on auditors for this.
Any quick comments on why you included Bernie and AOC? Any quick thoughts on them?
Oh, just because they've been more outspoken. If I go back to 2016, at that point, AOC was still a bartender somewhere. But Bernie was running for president with Hillary, and they're just pushing each other further to the left, and you're going to have free tuition and free this, and free, everything was free. And no economist, even a liberal economist, thinks that free tuition is a good idea.
So let's now get to emails 2, 3, and 4. You can flip over the sheet right there. These are all responses that you have given to students asking to be a part of your class for the next quarter. So I have them bulleted 1, 2, and 3. I want you to read each of them, then I'll ask you the follow-up questions.
Mm-hmm. So first one, you did not bid for the course. This is, again, presumably somebody who wanted to get in. You did not bid for the course during 8th week, so the probability of your getting in is equal to that of your replacing Bryce Harper in Philadelphia. Sorry, but a firm no. Number two, there were 250 students who did bid for Econ 100 but did not rank at number one. What if 100 of them now came to me and said that something was wrong with my computer and I could only have you as number two? That's an unverifiable dog ate my homework excuse. And then number three, easy decision for me, tough for you, no.
So,
the one I suppose, and I'm sure I'm not unique here, the one student request that I love the most when they want to get in one of my courses is saying, you know, I really want to get, I looked at my schedule and your course fits perfectly into my schedule. And I was like, what the hell? Is that the highest priority? You're looking for a course that doesn't meet too early in the morning or too late in the afternoon. And, you know, it's a good thing to take right after lunch. You don't care about the material. Just, it's convenient. You know, don't ever tell a faculty member that. Okay, it's just, that's insulting.
And the response to number one, where you talked about Bryce Harper, the student, when they sent that to me, they told me, quote, that you ended their career with your response. What do you say to that?
Gee, I hope that's not true. Economists don't have much of a sense of humor, but I would like to think that nobody's going to take that serious, or they could Google who Bryce Harper is or something. No, it just, at some point it has to be no. I wish it weren't no. I wish, you know, it's not that I want to double my teaching load. I'd like to see my colleagues do some lectures too in this course.
So the final email I have for you, this is in response to this podcast. So I want you to read it, and then I'll ask you the follow-up question. The last email here for Sandersonisms.
Okay. So thanks for forwarding this. I listened to it, what you sent me, or as much as I could stand. Don't take this personally. I consider sports talk radio to be the lowest form of human interaction. This guy confirms my stance. I can't remember who it was at the time, but it's the one media option I have steadfastly refused to participate in. We can talk about it if you want sometime during or after the quarter. I know there's an audience for stuff out there. I don't object to other folks having a different, higher or lower taste than I do. But in terms of sports economics, this type of coverage is worthless or lower. One of the things, and then again, and don't take it personally, as a former student and a very good student, I don't do sports talk radio in part because there's too much emphasis on sports. Almost, as some would say, a sports reporter is almost an oxymoron, or maybe just moron. A lot of talk radio is just, you know, like drunk guys in the stands, you know, yelling their opinion, and I'd like something behind it. Even at higher levels, the course, the economics of sports course that I'm teaching this quarter, started the first day with sort of 50 questions to brush up their knowledge of introductory or basic or even intermediate economics, and we'll pull stories, a sentence, a paragraph from the Wall Street Journal or New York Times, Sports Illustrated, just to show them the economic nonsense behind the particular statement they're making, whether it's about ticket prices and player salaries or the value of the Olympic Games or will the Astros win again next year. Behind everything, you know, there's probably some theory, there's probably some empirical evidence, and I just like more of that. And again, what's good about the University of Chicago, what I think is good about Econ 100 and 102 is be able to bring in, and I try to make equal fun of Republicans and Democrats. It's pretty easy to do. but to sort of show a statement that somebody makes and just how utterly ridiculous it is.
One final question. Mm-hmm. So based off of that email, now that you're here on the podcast, and I'm going to be posting this the next day, two questions. Number one, has your opinion changed? And number two, will you listen to this podcast when I post it?
Well, the answer number two, yes, I will.
Okay.
And I guess the answer number one is yes as well. This is, I don't look at this at all anywhere close in the same genre as Sports Talk Radio. Okay. This is an intellectual discussion, exchange of ideas. There just isn't that much of an exchange of ideas in the sort of sports talk radio world. Now, I will say I have done some in the past. I've done one for, I won't name him, but a local sports talk radio guy, because he was in fact dating a graduate student in the political science department. And so as a favor to him, I did this. And there are some sports writers in town that I will occasionally have as a visitor, visiting lecturer for my sports economics class. But I carefully select which ones to allow to come in.
Well, Professor Sanderson, I cannot thank you enough. This was such a fun interview, and I really appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Again, my pleasure.
Well, there you have it, an unforgettable interview today with Professor Alan Sanderson from the University of Chicago. We touched on a number of sports economics-related subjects, including the NCAA and its unwillingness to pay its players. We also talked about the Cubs and their season thus far, plus took a look back at his amazing teaching career, and yes, had lots of fun there near the end with Sandersonisms the game. I'm so glad that you decided to join us along for the ride today. Before we finish up now, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Instagram at John Zags, Twitter at John Z Sports, and LinkedIn at John Zagluel. Also, if you'd like to become a subscriber to the website, simply type in your email on the subscription box of the site, click yes on the confirmation email, and from there, you'll be subscribed. You'll receive every new podcast and article directly to your email. And remember, Sports Talk Chicago is now on iTunes and Google Play. Simply search Sports Talk Chicago and every podcast from the 2018-19 calendar year is now available. Feel free to leave us a 5-star rating and or write a review. Your support is greatly appreciated. And finally, if you enjoyed today's podcast, make sure to check out my new radio show every Tuesday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.5 WHPK-FM Chicago. You'll still hear my same hard-hitting Chicago sports opinions, plus we'll cover national sports news, have special segments, and of course, welcome very special guests to each and every show. Again, that's every Tuesday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.5 WHPK-FM Chicago. Thank you again for listening in to today's show, and have a great day.